You may have, yeah.
Well, my name is Tom Lamb. I would like to introduce to the court certified senior law student Hannah Carol Altman, who, with previous permission of the court, will be conducting the argument on behalf of the student.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Welcome.
Thank you.
Again, this is State versus Zuniga. You may proceed. And it was Ms. Altman, is that correct? Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Carol Altman, being a certified law student on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Zuniga. I please the court, counsel. We're here to ask that this court affirm, or excuse me, this court find that the district court erred in failing to sustain Mr. Zuniga's motion to suppress. I think the chain of events here is very important. Fast forwarding to the point where the defendant and the three officers are in his apartment.
How much time had elapsed by then before they even went to the apartment?
30 to 45 minutes by the time they got upstairs.
Okay, thank you.
The officers requested to search the apartment, and Mr. Zuniga denied that. They asked a second time to search, and again he denied.
And was that immediately, or was that after about 10 minutes in the apartment?
It was about 10 minutes in, correct. His response to each of these, instead of saying, yes, you can search, his response was showing his concern. He was explaining how he was concerned, essentially describing his distrust of law enforcement. He explained about a previous encounter that he had had with law enforcement in which he felt set up, felt like he was treated unfairly. This was showing the vulnerable side of Mr. Zuniga, and that's actually one of the factors to take into consideration here, determining that consent was not given voluntarily.
Does the fact that he had been through a similar situation before weigh in on this at all?
I think it does. I think the fact that he did have exposure to this type of situation, and he had previously felt misled or set up by enforcement, law enforcement, I think that's major. He's expressing to these officers that he had been in a situation previously that he felt wasn't fair, similar to what was happening at this point in time.
Does that help him or does that hurt him? Because he's been through it before, does he have, should we expect him to be more savvy to the situation?
I don't think just because he's had previous experience he should necessarily be more savvy. I think that, again, one of the circumstances to consider is the possible vulnerable state of the defendant when consent is given. And this is showing his vulnerability. It's showing that he's concerned. He's not giving consent immediately. At the point that he did give consent, officers have made promises to him.
Did he actually say no? I'm sorry, because he was asked two or three times by one officer and then a couple times by another. Did he actually say no, or did he just keep talking about the past experience?
I'm unclear as to that. There definitely were pauses in between, but it definitely was not answered with yes immediately. At that point, then, officers made promises to Mr. Zuniga. They promised that it wasn't their goal. They weren't going to arrest him. He wasn't going to prison, and they were only there to ensure the drugs would be removed from the home for public safety reasons. And it was...
Well, did they actually promise him that they were not going to arrest him, or did they say it was not their goal? Did they always just talk in terms of what their goal was, that their goal was to take drugs so the drugs wouldn't be distributed there anymore? Or their goal... did they ever say that our goal is not to arrest you?
Our goal is not that you get arrested. Our goal is not to send you to prison. Our goal is for public safety reasons. Despite the fact that officers did not explicitly say, I promise you that you are not going to be arrested, or I promise you you're not going to prison, it sets a dangerous precedent to allow officers to make promises to individuals so long as they don't use the magic words, I promise. I think what matters here is the understanding of Mr. Zuniga and the understanding of what an objective, reasonable person in that situation would think. Based on all of the circumstances leading up to this point, he had been with the officers for upwards of an hour at this point. He had already expressed vulnerability. He was in a custodial-like situation. He was not afforded Miranda. Considering all of these circumstances, he did rely upon these promises made by officers when he finally did give consent.
Could have he said, no, you can't come in, I'll see you later?
Yes, he certainly could have said that.
Okay. When you got inside, could have he asked them to leave?
He could have asked them to leave, yes, and I believe the district court, the order overruling the motion to suppress, as well as the brief of the state, they both note that the defendant did not ask them to leave, and the officers did not say he couldn't leave. But neither of those note that the officers did not tell him he could leave. Once upstairs, inside in the apartment, it's not reasonable for Mr. Zuniga to just leave himself, leaving three officers in his home. That's not practical. A reasonable person in that situation wouldn't just leave officers in their home.
When he went downstairs, I mean, there's no question they used a ruse to get him downstairs.
They did.
So once he goes down and sees that his car was not damaged, why doesn't he just turn around and go back up to his apartment? He had no duty to do anything else down there, did he?
Correct. No, he did not. Presumably, it would be suspicious if you just come down, realize officers are lying to you, and then walk away. They're likely going to follow up. He presumed that he didn't really have much of a choice other than to comply with officers, and when they say, we just want to talk to you about this, his understanding is believing them that they just want to talk.
It's not your position that when he first went down and encountered the three officers to check out his car, that he wasn't in custody at that point?
At that point in time, no, he was not in custody. They were just having the conversation. I'm not sure there's an exact point in time in which the custodial situation began, but I would definitely say once they were upstairs into the apartment, again, three officers to a single Mr. Zuniga, it's not practical for him to just leave them in there. At that point in time, I would definitely say it was a custodial situation.
He could have asked them to leave. He could have chosen not to invite them in.
Correct. He could have. Again, a person in that situation would just think that they don't have much option other than to comply with officers. So if officers want to speak with you, they're expecting you to speak. It's not, you wouldn't think automatically that it's okay to just disregard officers and just walk away.
And there's no recording of any of the conversations, is there?
There's not.
There's eight factors in the Rogers case, and they're pretty well settled as to what we look at for custody. Can you go through those factors and tell us which ones you think work in his favor to show that he was in custody?
Despite there not being handcuffs around his wrist, he was in a situation in which a reasonable, objective person would feel that they weren't free to leave. Again,
you keep saying a reasonable, objective person. Is that what our standard is, or are we to look at him and his own personal characteristics?
I believe we should look at what a reasonable person would do in this situation. And again, with reliance upon the officers, their promises that they're making to him, a reasonable person in that situation, too, would believe officers for what they're saying and think that if it's a promise, you're not going to be arrested or go to prison, that they would believe the officer.
Problem I have is, you know, we can talk about the reasonable person, but this particular person had a prior experience that should have had him a little bit more leery of what was going on here.
I agree. I think he was very leery, and that's why he expressed his vulnerability in explaining why he was so concerned, and in an attempt to make sure this wasn't another setup and another time in which police were trying to trap him, so to say. He made it clear that he was very concerned about how law enforcement was handling the situation, and he was very concerned that he was going to be arrested or go to prison previously, and when he was told that those things are not going to happen, then he complied and gave consent.
So it's interesting. Your take on the past experience is that it made him more vulnerable in many ways, rather than, as Judge Arterburg was talking about earlier, that maybe he should have had more savvy about it. It actually made him more vulnerable.
I believe so. He didn't have to share that with officers. He didn't have to share that standpoint or previous experience, but he chose to. I believe that does show his vulnerability. I'd like to reserve my little amount of time left for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. Appellant argues the district court erred in overruling his motion to suppress, and the state believes the district court correctly concluded that appellant's consent to search was voluntary and that he was not in custody for purposes of Miranda, and we ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. To be effective under the Fourth Amendment, a consent to search must be a free and unconstrained choice and not the product of a will overborne. It must not be the result of duress or coercion, either complied, physical, or psychological. And whether a consent to search is voluntary is to be determined from the totality of the circumstances surrounding the giving of consent. Here are some of the factors the district court looked at that found in favor of voluntariness of the consent, or that there was no evidence the appellant was under the influence of drugs or alcohol during his discussion with investigators. There was no evidence he suffered from any mental impairment, and that he had prior involvement with law enforcement and the justice system. He was outside with investigators and consented to them coming up into his apartment. The consent was given in the familiar surroundings of his apartment, that there were no threats or physical intimidation used by officers, and that appellant never asked to leave, nor did he ask for counsel. And the state believes that the totality of the circumstances shows, as the district court determined, that the consent to search was given freely, voluntarily, and intelligently.
Was it, I'm trying to find the right words, lawyers were involved, we probably refer to it as sharp practice, but was it a little sneaky on behalf of the police, the way they got him down there and got that whole thing launched?
Your Honor, I think once appellant did come down the stairs, I can't recall which officer testified to it, but he said he identified himself right away and the other officers using first and last names, and that they said, "We're actually here to talk to you." I believe they identified that they were with, I don't recall the name of the drug task force, but with a unit that specifically worked on narcotics, and that they actually wanted to talk to him about drug sales. And I think at that point, appellant could have said, "My car's fine. I don't want to talk about this. I'm going back upstairs," and he didn't. So I think that there were places where appellant could have chosen to end the encounter, and he voluntarily stayed and spoke with officers.
Well, and there were three of them there. So let's go to the once they're in the apartment, because I think it is a little bit questionable, this, whether he was in custody or not. When you have three officers there, they have been talking to him for 30 to 45 minutes already.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do note, I believe it was Officer Hallowell testified that initially when appellant came downstairs, there were three officers, but I believe it was Hallowell, there were three officers involved, sort of stepped away for a little bit. And so it was really more, it wasn't three officers, as I recall, kind of all surrounding him and boxing him in.
But it was a couple of them saying, "Oh, it's cold. Can we go inside?"
Correct,
and they do that repeatedly. So they get inside.
They get inside.
There's three of them in an apartment.
That's correct. And as I recall, one of the officers, it was kind of a living room, kitchen, just as an apartment is set up, that one sort of went off into the living room, and then again two were a little closer to appellant speaking. And so I don't think appellant, but all three officers testified that when they went up the stairs, appellant was the one to enter the apartment first.
Is there any evidence that once they got there, he was told that he could ask them to leave at any time?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that any officer informed him. I don't exactly recall, but I don't remember reading
and,
that.
And it's clear the officers and not Mr. Zuniga initiated this contact.
Correct.
And you'd have to agree there were some deceptive strategies employed here.
I think, well, to get him down, yes, officers did say that your car had been maybe involved in a hit and run.
And what about the goal situation?
Your Honor, I think that is a vague statement that was very carefully phrased, to not make any promises. And this is where I think I disagree with counsel on where the prior law enforcement experience or interactions comes up. I think that was a very carefully phrased statement that did not make any promises. And I think that someone who is already suspicious of law enforcement is going to view a vague statement with, you know, with a little more suspicion, that a vague statement that my goal is not to arrest you is a lot different than saying, I will not arrest you if you just give me the drugs. I will not file a report. I will walk away.
So Mr. Zuniga needed to say, your goal, do you mean you promise? I mean, it's up to the defendant to get clarification, so to speak.
I don't think the officers were making a promise. I suppose I can't speak for them, but I don't know, based on what we've seen here, that they were going to say, sure, give us the drugs and we'll walk away. I think that the statement, when viewed, this is a totality of the circumstances test. And I recognize that that statement, this court may have find it a little troubling, but I think it was a vague statement, carefully phrased, that did not make any definite promises, and that when viewed in the totality of the circumstances, it was not sufficient to coerce appellant or to overcome his will.
So even if we get past the word choices, I still want to go back to the custody in the apartment. All right, because I was walking you through MATA's six factors that are generally considered, and I think it was about the fourth or fifth one. The questioning was dominated by the police. You'd agree?
Well, I think that the asking questions, I think there was testimony from the officers that there were periods of silence and that appellant would then kind of espouse on his previous experience with law enforcement. So I don't know if we know for sure that it was mostly officers talking and he just responded once in a while. I think there was testimony that he spoke at length about his prior experience with law enforcement and some of his concerns, and but I don't really know if we can say it was 50-50 or if it was one more than the other.
Right, and he was placed under arrest at the termination of the
correct session. After the drugs had been found, he was placed under arrest.
Tell me how it wasn't custodial.
Well, Your Honor, I think appellant came downstairs voluntarily. I understand.
I'm beyond the downstairs, in the apartment.
So officers asked for consent. Appellant voluntarily allowed them to come in. He went through the apartment first, allowed officers into the apartment, never told officers, I want you to leave, or I think that I don't want to talk to you anymore, I want to leave, or I want my attorney. Officers never told him, you're not free to leave. I just think in view of all the circumstances, I think the district court found he was not in custody, and I think that was a correct finding. I think there's no evidence that he was tried to leave, told he couldn't, or stopped from leaving, that he ever asked officers to leave, or indicated that he didn't want to speak with them anymore, or wanted the encounter to terminate.
So he sat down or something, right?
I believe he did sit in a chair at one point, yes.
Is there any evidence of where the officers were located?
I know that the officers, I believe that one officer was near the drawers in the kitchen where the officers believed that the drugs were and where they were ultimately found. But I don't recall if the chair was in the living room area or the kitchen area. I just don't recall from the record. I there may have been testimony about where the parties were situated, but I don't recall at this time.
I mean, they knew what they were there to do. Why would we not expect officers at that point, once they're in his apartment, to just give him his Miranda rights?
I think, Your Honor, appellant at that point had been and was voluntarily conversing with officers. They were having a back and forth conversation, and I think could they have? Yes, but I don't think that means that they had
should
to.
Have.
Yeah, correct. I think that appellant was voluntarily conversing with them, and at that point, everything is voluntary, and he was not in custody. I think the district court correctly determined he was not in custody and that Miranda did not apply.
From the record, wasn't there evidence that he fairly readily admitted his involvement with drugs? The question was just whether he was going to get consent.
I know that after, when he was questioned, he did admit to it, and I believe officers testified that he never denied there were drugs there. I don't recall exactly what he said before, but it was never a denial that, no, there's no drugs in the apartment, no, you're wrong, nothing like that. I have reached the end of my prepared remarks.
There were no neutral parties present.
Correct, Your Honor. It was three officers and appellant.
And in your opinion, is the duration of this encounter Do we include the time before the apartment time?
Your Honor, I haven't really analyzed that issue. I think it's difficult because, you know, we say 30 minutes, and sometimes 10 minutes goes very quickly, and sometimes it stretches on. So I just don't know. I'm not sure if that should be included. I don't think overall it was an unreasonable amount of time, especially considering, you know, they were outside, this was all voluntary, they moved in, it was voluntary, they had some conversation. I believe there was testimony, there was some conversation in the apartment, maybe 5 to 10 minutes about things other than drugs.
Because the longer these conversations go, the more likely it starts to feel like...
I understand, Your Honor. I just think viewing everything, this started out as a consensual encounter. I think it continued up until the time appellant was arrested. I see that I am out of time, so unless there are further questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. And how much time does appellant have left? 16 seconds, Ms. Altman, come on.
I just wanted to note that the officers here seem to be taking a lot of risks that they probably shouldn't have. They first singled out Mr. Zuniga, his apartment. They knew which drawer that they wanted to search. They should have just had a warrant to begin with. Once they got up to the apartment, they should have given him Miranda.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming and presenting to us today. It's nice to have you here. Thank you, Stephanie.